This is Andy Clark, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 17th of October 2012. Andy Clark, Part 1.
Andy Clark, London, North London, 27th January 1949. I actually grew up in the Islington before it became the People's Republic of Islington.
So you're now how old?
Oh dear, what a calculation. It makes me 63. I do actually have to make the calculation.
Tell me about your parents.
That's an interesting question. My parents were an unusual mix for the time. My father was a child, one of five children, born in East London, Leytonstone area, brought up there, and he trained in local government. As with so many of that generation, that training was cut short when he was deployed during the war. He was in radar during the war, radar operator, and hence, although he didn't see action, travelled a lot, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa and Malta. And that's where I think he picked up something that stayed with him for the rest of his life, which was a love of deserts. And I think that somehow has made it through. It can't be in the genes, but somehow it's made it through to me, because I like hot deserts almost as much as I like cold deserts. My mother was very different. She was born in Dublin. She was extrovert, Irish, a Catholic. My father's family was not. And that led to some... At that time, a mixed marriage was not very common. But the problem was solved, if I can put it that way, when my mother's father was killed by the V2 that demolished Smithfield Market. My mother was in the RAF during the war. She was a fitter on Hurricane and Spitfire aircraft, had the time of her life during the war, and has many good stories to tell about it. Sadly, neither of them are alive at the moment. After my father retired from local government in Islington, they moved to North Norfolk, a very isolated village in North Norfolk, Haysborough, the one that always appears on the news bulletins when they're looking at coastal erosion. And they're in the churchyard in Haysborough Church now.
So you were brought up in Norfolk, effectively?
I know, I was brought up in London. That was after my father's retirement that we moved. I'm essentially a Londoner, or I am a Londoner. And it's a moot point whether I'm North London or East London. We grew up within sound of the Arsenal football stadium. My father was a season ticket holder. When he gave up playing, he was a very good amateur footballer, but had to give up at the age of 40 because of an ankle injury. He took out a season ticket at Arsenal, and my two younger brothers were and remain fanatical Arsenal supporters, and I decided that I was going to go somewhere else. So I went to West Ham, and so I often say I'm actually an East Londoner. The truth is we were born on the boundary between East and North London, and by the strict definition of the sound of Bow Bells, I'm about 500 metres from being a proper Cockney.
Do you ever wonder whether you back the right team?
Yes, frequently, but... there are many choices you make in life which have no rational basis whatsoever. And supporting a football club or any sports team is actually an emotional decision. It's an emotional thing, not a rational thing. By any rational thing, we'd all support Manchester United. I don't.
Neither do I. Where did your interest in biology come from?
Question I'm often asked, and I don't fully know. What I can say is that I know that I had a very... unusual and inspirational zoology master as a school child. Because my mother was a Catholic, I went to a Jesuit school. It was actually not all Jesuit teaching. It was mixed. There were lay teachers there as well. But interestingly, the two most influential teachers were, one was a Jesuit priest who was a physics teacher who had moved away from being a research physicist to enter the ministry. I'm not sure ministry is the right word for the Catholics, but... and the other was... a lay teacher of zoology, who was a Polish gentleman, taught in the old-fashioned way of where you learn things by rote, but he gave us some freedom and his approach was interesting. And so I remember that as being part of my education. Whether that was the reason, I can't put my finger on. It's something I've actually been musing on recently, because since I retired and we moved up to Norfolk, one of the reasons for moving to Norfolk is I'm a keen birder. And Norfolk's probably the best location in the country for all-round birding. And in retirement, I've started to look back through my old birding records. And my first birding notebook was written when I was 12, and it records a day out in Norfolk. So whatever it was started early, but I can never put my finger on it. But it was encouraged by my parents. Once they realised I was interested in zoology and particularly keen on birding. You know, my father bought me a pair of binoculars for a Christmas present, and it went from there. So it's one of these things I suspect it just evolved gradually and was supported, rather than there being a, you know, a seminal road to Damascus moment at some stage in my career. I think it was just something that emerged. Strange, seeing as I was living in the centre of a city.
And where do you think your first awareness that there might be a place on this planet called the Antarctic, when would that have happened?
I don't know. I mean, my parents were very keen on education, so we had a lot of encyclopedias and atlases around. So I knew of Antarctica way, way back, but exactly when I first learned of it, I don't know. It was just part of my general education. I probably became aware of it at the same time as I became aware of where places like Afghanistan or India were, because obviously there are points in your upbringing when you don't know those things, and then gradually, you know, as part of education, you learn where these things are.
But the family have owned a globe.
We did, actually, yes. We owned a globe, and it was one that you could buy, I think, you know, from... Well, they didn't have Sunday colour supplements in those days, but that sort of thing. You bought it through an advertisement. And I remember vividly because it had a bulb inside it, so it illuminated. And so you could light it from the inside. And it was a political map of, or it, rather than a physical globe, it showed the political boundaries. And as was the notion at the time, large bits were coloured actually pink or whatever.
So the bit, of course, at the bottom of the globe would have been white, wouldn't it, not pink?
Yes, it was. And I didn't think anything of it. I mean, my interest in polar regions didn't really start until I experienced them as an undergraduate.
Well, there's a reference in some of your notes here to a grainy photograph of South Georgia.
Ah, yes, yes. Well, as I said, my parents, as I mentioned, were keen on education. And I mean, another part of an answer to a question we've already tackled, which I didn't give then, I think, is that I was given a lot of freedom as a child. I was the eldest surviving child. In those days, not all children survived, and I was the oldest surviving child. And I was given a remarkable amount of freedom. I used to spend a large amount of my time in the school holidays in the Natural History Museum. Well, that was the other side of London, but it so happened that the number 30 bus would run from outside my door virtually to outside the Natural History Museum. So it was a single bus ride, a long one, but my parents were obviously happy for me to do that, and I spent a lot of time there. They also allowed me to... I used to wander up the Holloway Road, as it still is, which is where the Islington Public Library was, and they had a children's section in there, and I used to wander actually out of the children's section into the adult section. And the book in question was actually the Duke of Edinburgh's book on Birds from Britannia, which is a series of very grainy photographs taken on his visit to the Antarctic. And one of the photographs he took, I now know, was actually in Cumberland Bay in South Georgia. And it was obviously a very dark and stormy day. And it's a very evocative photograph of a part of Cumberland Bay that I now well recognise. But at the time, it was just an extremely evocative photograph of a place that I thought was the sort of place nobody ever got. And even if you got there, you wouldn't necessarily be sure you wanted to be there. It looked that bleak and forbidding. But as luck would have it, I ended up there. So that
photograph stayed in your memory, obviously.
Yes, it wasn't the reason I went, but the photograph stayed in my memory. In fact, it's the only photograph in the book that I could probably recall now. You know, many of the photographs in there wouldn't pass muster now with modern equipment and modern eye, with the ability to capture images of seabirds, etc. now. But that one remains with me.
You chose biology as your university degree, which was at Cambridge?
Yes, yeah, I was... I mean, that was something... Like many of my generation, I was the first of my family to go to university. And my parents, obviously, without pushing in any way at all, obviously had aspirations. I had no idea whether I was good, bad or indifferent, but they suggested I apply for Cambridge. I did. I got in. And the college was effectively chosen, effectively for me, in that my father took advice. And his boss, or someone he worked with at the Islington Borough Council, was a graduate of Corpus Christi. And recommended the college. It turned out to be a very good college to be at. It has its idiosyncrasies. It's not strong in all areas, but it turned out to be a very good location for me. And I had a fine 3 years. I thoroughly enjoyed my undergraduate career there. And by then, I was fairly fixed on doing biology. But in the Cambridge system at the time, you didn't specialise till your third year. And you do a natural sciences degree. And so in the first 2 years, the options were biology, but you had to do other subjects. There was a minimum number of modules, we would call it now, courses at the time, that you had to do. And I had to find another one. So in my first year, I did the two mandatory biology courses, both of which were new that year, so experimental. And I decided I'd do geology. And I got totally hooked. I thought geology was tremendous. So in my second year, I did the one mandatory biology. I did geology, and then I did philosophy of science as an add-on, which was optional at that stage. You could only do two if you wished. I thought philosophy of science sounded interesting, so I did that. Come the end of 2 years, I had to make a decision as to whether I stayed with biology or whether I actually followed geology, which had really captured me. In the end, it was a very close thing, and I stayed with biology. I sometimes say I tossed a coin. I actually didn't physically do that, but it was mentally that. And it was a very close run thing. But in the end, I stayed with it. And as much as any reason, it was because in my second year, we had a very charismatic lecturer who showed me what zoology could be like. Whereas in the first year, organismal biology, as we would call it now, was taught in a very stulted, old-fashioned, dry and exceedingly boring manner. And I also blame that first year course for the fact that only now have I got interested in plants in my 60s.
So do you want to name that inspirational?
Yes, he was Martin Wells, great-grandson of H.G. And sadly he died a few years ago, but he wrote a little book called Lower Animals, which I still have on my bookshelf. Mm-hmm. And what was fascinating about it was that the traditional way of teaching animals was you started at the lower end as the old-fashioned approach, amoeba to man, effectively, and you worked up from single cells through insects and what were then called the lower animals up to the higher animals, vertebrates. It's the wrong way of looking at animals, but that's the way it was treated. And you just slogged through them group by group. Martin's approach was to throw all of that out and come in and say, well, when an animal gets from A to B, it has to move. This is how animals move. And this group of animals do it this way, this group of animals do it that way, this group of animals do it this way. The common problem is you've got to get from A to B, and there are lots of ways of doing it. If they want to know where they are, they have to be able to sense their surroundings. So this is how insects sense their surroundings. This is how worms do it. You might not think they do it, but they do it this way. So he essentially, I suppose, he took a horizontal rather than a vertical look, or a vertical rather than a horizontal. And it was my first introduction to what these days we would call comparative biology. And I had never thought of animals in that way, and it was an enlightening moment delivered by a very charismatic lecturer. I mean, he was a tremendous lecturer to listen to. And it sold me that actually there was something interesting in comparative biology. And that's the approach I've had all my professional career, is comparative.
You joined BAS more or less straight away from university as a graduate. So what happened? What was the process? When did you start thinking that going south was a good idea?
Well, it goes back to experience halfway through. I mean, of my undergraduate career, in those days, the traditional thing was that the long vac labelled you to travel. And so in the long vac between school and university, I went off to central Anatolia. In those days, that was a long way from anywhere. I mean, there are package holidays there now, but those, my parents were aghast, I think, because the first time I'd gone abroad and I ended up in Asia. But the long vac after that, I found a little note on the geology notice board that said, would anyone like to go to Spitsbergen? The Cambridge Spitsbergen expedition, which was a geology expedition under the guidance of Bill Harland, who was a sort of stalwart of polar research in the Arctic. And they took undergraduates basically as field assistants, and you had to pay for it. And I had to go knock on my dad's door and say, any chance of 50 quid, which was actually a lot of money in those days, because I'd like to go to Svalbard. And they did. They paid up. And off I went. And that was what was my first experience of polar regions. And I was absolutely enthralled. I loved every moment I was up there. It was interesting and tough. I mean, we were under canvas all the time. We had a few little harum scarum moments. But it was fine. I came away convinced that that was great. But I thought that was going to be my only experience and that I'd go on and do something else. And in your last year, you were looking for PhDs, and I was anticipating that I'd be able to get a degree that would enable me to do a PhD. I fancied doing it. And of course, the job market was very different then. It was a question of which one of these various ones should I go for, rather than will I be able to find a job. And while I was looking around, I applied for one in Western Ontario to work on cardinal birds. I looked at one to work on geese in Canada, and there was an advertisement for a biologist to work on krill in the Antarctic. And I thought, that sounds interesting, I'll go for that. I didn't tell anyone I was going for it, particularly my then girlfriend, who I don't think was overly impressed when I announced I was thinking of going to the Antarctic for 2.5 years. I just didn't think in those terms of that. I mean, it sounded like a good job, I'd go for it, interesting. And so I did.
How did your parents react? So, I am going off for that length of time.
They were very supportive. I don't know what they felt internally. Mother's being mother, I'm sure, was concerned that their eldest son was going to disappear for 2.5 years. But there must be something in the upbringing, because my younger brother decamped to Africa, where he still is. And my middle brother is now in France. So, once they retired, family reunions were rare events. But much enjoyed by my mother when they were there. And the three sons made sure that on occasions we did all get there together with our partners and things. So those were good events. But I think she was sort of secretly proud of the fact that her children went off and did interesting things. And for the generation that we were, we did really quite interesting things. Nowadays, the ability to travel and the opportunities for those things are very much wider than they are now.
What do you remember of the Bass interview?
Surprisingly little, actually. I don't remember that much of the interview. It was Bill Sloman who did the interview, if I remember rightly, and I think Ted Clapp was there. And Dick Laws was the primary interviewer. And my only feedback from it was to chat to Dick once I was appointed and at Monkswood and preparing to go. And of course, I was a very member of junior staff, and Dick, as anyone who met him will know, is a very imposing figure. And he came and sat down beside me, and we got talking, and he asked me and said how I'd found the interview. And I said, well, I thought it was okay. I'd managed to get most things across. He said, and Dick's reply was, yes, he said, Andy, he said, the problem we have with most people is getting them to open up. He said, the problem we have with you is getting you to shut up. So that's the feedback. So I think I was nervous. Well, I know I was nervous, and I talk a lot when I'm nervous. So that was obviously it. What I do remember more vividly is the medical that followed, because I didn't know at the time, but obviously they have an initial assessment as yes or no, they're a possible candidate or definitely not. And they only medical the ones that they think are at least a possibility. So I was dispatched around the corner, if I remember rightly, to a medical from one surgeon, Colonel Hayward, who was a very tall, imposing gentleman. I think I commented in my thing of ferocious eyebrows that met in the middle, made Dennis Healy look small. gave me an interview and a very subtle and I remember the medical rather very, very vividly, because it was only afterwards I realised the subtle way he carried it out. For example, he would stand across the room and bellow at me and said, I'm just testing your hearing now. Seems fine to me. And I thought, well, of course I can hear that. He's bellowing at me. But it was only afterwards I realised that he'd asked me to view the eye chart very quietly. And so he'd actually tested my hearing by asking me to watch the eye chart. And the rest of the interview was done like that. It was done in a kind of a bleak and subtle way. And he was a military gentleman, so he obviously knew about sort of dealing with people. And it was only on reflection afterwards I realised what a sort of subtle and interesting job he'd done.
So were you being psyched out by
him? No, but I learned afterwards that they did ask Surgeon Colonel Hayward for his comments on psychological suitability. So at no stage virtually in the history that I'm aware of did we ever use psychometric testing, which of course is famously...
But most vids think, when you ask them, they think about it, they think they were actually being asked searching questions at the interview about how they got on with other people. And
yes, I mean, I was asked, and in my experience of interviewing at Bass, which lasted some 20-odd years, yes, you do have some standard questions or standard approaches. It would be wrong to say I had a standard question, but there are some routine things that you do explore.
So you were sussing out candidates psychologically as well, were you, later on?
Yes, I mean, people often ask you how you do it, and actually it's quite straightforward. You know, I interviewed mostly for biological posts, and sometimes I would sit in on the diving or boatman, but that was not usual. So it's mainly for technical jobs, and in interviewing people you're making two assessments effectively in parallel. You have to decide whether the person can actually do the job that is there. You know, are they good enough to do the diving in the Antarctic? Do they have the qualifications for the technique? Are they suitable to be the boatman? is this person a good biologist or not? That's the technical assessment. At the same time, and in a non-formal manner, you're also deciding whether or not they would be suitable for the Antarctic. And the way you approach it is basically to ask yourself, could I live alongside that person? That's the question I ask myself. Mm. And it wasn't my job as the technical part of the interview. It's usually the establishments or personnel section who would ask the questions about exploring what they're like in a community environment. And it usually explored things like, have you lived in a communal house? How did you organise the cleaning of that? And those questions, you usually expose the sort of approaches that people have, because obviously you're living in a common environment down there. It's a mucking in system. There's a rota system for clearing and sorting things out. And you need to know that the person will be able to adapt to that. I mean, much more interesting, here's one of the stories that, yes, I wouldn't name names in this particular case, but I will give you a... In the latter stages, of course, David Walton and I, when we had a position of managerial influence, the day I was appointed to run marine life sciences, David was already running botany or terrestrial sciences. And David called me out and said, Andy, now there's two of us, we can perhaps get something done. You know, the number of biologists on the board or the director's committee, as it then was, has gone up. Let's go off to the pub and see what we can sort out. Is there anything that, as a combined force, we can do? And we went to the pub, and it took us 2 seconds to decide what we were going to do. And that was, we had to break the glass ceiling and get women into the Antarctic. And that was our challenge. And we gave ourselves 5 years, and we did it in 2. And we did it in parallel. David was absolutely instrumental in it because he sat on all the various committees, drew up the reports and everything else. He jokes that my approach was practical. I simply appointed loads of women. they argue I was positively discriminating. I was arguing I was appointing the best people on the day. But, of course, introducing women into what had previously been an all-male environment is a major step. Not all of the people who were down there at the time or who viewed Bass as a career or whatever weren't overly happy with it. There are some people who didn't appreciate the change. I think it's been an unqualified success personally, but there were some difficult steps to come over psychologically. And there was also the question of how we introduce those first women into the system. And that led to the most memorable interview answer I have ever had. We were interviewing a student, and this was an extra complication because we'd started to set up relationships with universities. And, of course, it's the university that appoints the student. So I went to Richard Hansen, who was the personnel officer at the time, and said, Richard, we've got a procedural problem here. The university have appointed a student, and the plan is for them to go south. But this is someone we have not interviewed in any way. How do we deal with this? And we resolved it by saying, well, what we'll do is we'll agree that the studentship will go ahead. We've got plenty of material that she can work on. It was a she in this country. But just say that the fieldwork element is just subject to a brief informal interview at Bass. So he brought her up. I said, that's fine, Richard, that will work. Now you've got that clear, I should tell you that this person is blonde and drop-dead gorgeous. Richard, OK. So we brought her in, Karen her name was, and we brought her in, and Richard's face virtually, jaw hit the floor, I think, when she came in. Anyway, the interview went well. She was vivacious, outgoing, very smart, did some nice science, and could clearly do the job. And so Richard started to explore the sort of more potentially problematic areas. So he sort of said, well, I need to ask you. I said, you must realise, Karen, that you're one of the first women that will be taking into what was previously an all-male environment. And Karen said, yes, and about time too. So Richard said, well, I just need to explore a few things. Do you mind if I ask you, he said, have you ever been the victim of unwanted sexual advances? And Karen said, oh, yes, plenty of time. So Richard said, what do you do? She said, I tell him to fuck off. And at that moment, it was the best answer she could have had. And we just fell about laughing. And it turned out that was also pretty well an indication of the way she dealt with life in general. But it's still one of the best answers I think I've had. It was straight, direct and to the point.
And was she appointed?
She was, yes. And she caused a few waves, but she did the job. She came away, yes.
Well, I mean, apart from the history of no women ever go south with Bass, what were the huge barriers that you and David have also had to climb to get that first woman to go south?
I think just... It's a very sensible question. It's actually not an easy one to answer. I would say probably entrenched old-fashioned attitudes in a small number of managerial staff that we had to persuade that this was a necessary step.
Will these be military types?
Often of, yes. And would it be? Sometimes, but not always. I would say just more of an old-fashioned approach to life. In the end, that if those objections were effectively overridden by a majority vote, we never had a formal vote, but the world moved on inexorably. But there were some difficulties with it. I mean, an example, I had to, the first station that we took women to was Cygni. These weren't the first women through Bass to the Antarctic at all, but the first sort of formal place where we had them first doing summers and then wintering was Cygni Island. Cygni was a small, old-fashioned base. And it was fascinating because, you know, the standard objections were advanced. There are no facilities for them. Okay, no, let's build some. You know, it's not, you know, we do have, but we can build things. Okay, so they constructed a small porter cabin which would have two women's toilets in them. And for some reason that I never understood, this was actually delivered to the ship, already plumbed in. So it weighed an absolute ton. And of course, everything that comes ashore at Cygni is carried by hand. And the plan was that this would go ashore, up the ramp, through the station, round the back, and be parked at the back side of the station. Well, it took four scaffolding poles and four people on each scaffolding pole to lift this. And we were carrying it up the ramp, and it became clear within a foot there was no way this was going round the back. It was physically impossible to get it round there. So it was eventually manoeuvred up to the front of the station and placed by the door, where it just so happened that the muck pipe ran out. So it was plumbed in directly into the muck pipe and sat there. It was never, ever used. what happened was that there was already a system in place. The urinal was, there was a urinal on the wall. That was partitioned off out of courtesy. But there were two cubicles and then two showers. And the showers, again, had been partitioned off previously anyway. And a system simply evolved, which was that if the shower was occupied, you shouted. And if it was the voice of the same sex that replied, you went in. If it was the voice of a different sex, you waited outside. And it problem was solved within minutes. I mean, the base evolved its own solution to the problem. So none of those practical problems that were often raised were ever a problem in reality on the ground.
Did you ever come across gender problems in the field, so that, you know, two in a tent?
No, I was not a field person in that sense. My work was based almost exclusively on station. So almost everything I did was based from a laboratory on the station, and the field work I did was small boat work.
And was there any way of talking to these women when they got back to say, how was it for you? Is that something you did?
I didn't do. People did. But my approach was simply to socialise with them and get a feel, because I was responsible for many of, not all, but many of the early appointments. And so I felt a sort of moral and managerial responsibility for them to make sure that, if you like, life was okay. And so I would talk to them. And mostly, they came through it okay. I think some of them found it tough, but we told them beforehand that it was potentially tough and we would have, there might be problems to solve on the way. Mm. There were a few problems to solve on the way. But I always say, in retrospect, I wouldn't change my view. There were emotional problems on all male bases. There were emotional problems and interpersonal problems on mixed bases. You simply changed the nature of the problem. They weren't any worse or any better. But overall, the social environment was greatly improved, in my opinion.
Less rugby club.
Less farting at dinner, for example. I mean, it's simple things. It was that sort of thing. The social atmosphere improved. Pornography disappeared. It went underground. It didn't disappear, but it just disappeared, you know, courtesy. I think overall the social environment was better, and the science environment was significantly improved, because you're recruiting from the whole population, not just half of it. And, you know, Bass benefited enormously by the first crop of people we sent through generally being very smart, very hardworking and very good. So they carved the career.
Well, they had a point to prove, I guess. They had an extra burden, didn't they?
They did. I mean, it would be wrong to say that it wasn't tough for those early ones. To deny that would be silly. It was tough. But they knew, at least in theory, what they were doing and the environment they were letting themselves in for, and they all handled it very, very well. I think we've had some very, very smart women scientists through.
Did any of the entrenched individuals come up to you later on and say, I'm sorry, you were right?
No, I think it's like many such things. It required the generation to pass on by retire. I think there was a general recognition that this was a necessary step. I mean, it was necessary in lots of ways, not just legally, apart from anything else. It was a necessary step to come to terms with modern times. And I think there was a recognition that that was so, and there was a recognition that we'd made the step and it hadn't been accompanied by the collapse of Western civilization, which was sometimes suggested it might be. But no one ever, but then people don't do that.
Let's flip that then. You're sailing south in 1970 to South Georgia to work on krill. Did the krill cooperate?
No, they didn't. The plan was that I think the original job description and idea for the project was that we would establish a marine biology station at South Georgia, probably at least initially in the old Discovery Investigations building, and which was nice because that's where marine biology history at South Georgia had taken place. So that was nice. And that we'd use that as a base, use small boats and scuba diving, and you use those as ways of collecting the animals. That would have worked if the animals had been there, but it turned out that for reasons that we don't yet fully understand, but there'd been a shift in the availability of krill. It's now apparent that that may be part of a long-term shift in populations, but we don't really have the data to be sure. But what we do know is that in the days when the Discovery investigations were active, krill were a lot more available close to shore at that site than they proved to be when we tried to repeat some of the work or develop and build on the work. So I was there with my supervisor, who was Inigo Everson, and the two of us built an aquarium, built a lab. The dry lab was actually, it turns out, in exactly the same place as the Discovery Investigations dry lab, which was kind of nice. And then set about sampling. But it became clear very quickly that this was going to be a much more difficult job than we'd anticipated. And before Inigo left to go home at the end of the summer, and I was to stay for the winter, he and I talked about the possibility that we might have to change the project.
Before you talk about what you did do, what were you hoping to find out about krill? And was it ever discovered?
We didn't have a formal plan in the sense that, we will look for X and Y. It was more a question of building on the Discovery Investigations work, which was extremely thorough, looking at growth rates, and in particular, I think Inigo was interested in exploring the biochemistry of krill, which is something that had only been looked at in a fairly simple way before. And that was an area also where techniques had moved on enormously since the Discovery Investigations days. I mean, ways of measuring growth rates and population size hadn't really changed. Mm. But what had changed was biochemistry and our understanding of physiology. Inigo came down with the idea of starting that, and I took that on board, effectively self-trained, because the stuff was, the equipment was there and there was a book there, and I had to learn. And we took it from there. I guess it's another thing that's changed now, not just in BASS, in science in general. This is a slight aside, but it's to illustrate the point. I had dinner recently with my wife's old boss, who's a world expert on spiders. And he's now 90, still very active, lives nearby. We went to lunch with him, and I started asking him about his career and his PhD, and it was at Oxford. And he'd been in to see his supervisor on the first day. He was a very famous ecologist called Charles Elton. And apparently Elton said, young man, I think you should go out into the local woods, have a look and see what you see, and come back and tell me if anything catches your eye. And apparently the student went out, came back and said, well, there seem to be an awful lot of spiders there. That's fine, my boy. Yes, find something to do with spiders. And that was the approach. much more open-ended. Nowadays, the approach is we have a grant to do this very specific piece of research and we are expecting the answer to be something like this. It's research has become very much more channeled and prescriptive, and it's part of a general change in science.
But in your day, it was almost like a blank canvas. So little was known, particularly about the Antarctic, that you could choose almost any subject and nobody had done it. Today, science has already been done in so many fields. So you've got to be more selective about the work you do, the effectiveness of the work you do.
Yes,
new things.
There is an element that it is less of a blank canvas now than it was. But even so, there are plenty of areas that we could explore. And actually, we carried the old-fashioned idea forward for as long as we were allowed to, effectively, in that as I moved through the system and then started having students of my own or supervising other people and setting up a research programme at Sydney, I took the old-fashioned approach, which is, well, let's ask a general question and then leave it up to the student to find something more specific, but have plenty of interactions to make sure that that student doesn't go off the rails or anything. Sometimes not everybody responds well to an open-ended. And I was talking with Inigo only the other day about one of the students or one of the biologists we employed who effectively delivered nothing. That wouldn't be possible now. The new system has its benefits in that you keep a much closer eye on students, and if they're not delivering, then either you change what they do or you change the supervisory regime or you ask them to move on. It's a very much more focused and structured existence now than it was.
You had one or two problems with your research, particularly trying to bring samples back to the UK.
Oh, yes, that story, yeah. Well, Inigo and I had largely come to the joint conclusion that work on krill was probably not going to be possible. But the final decision was, I think, if I remember rightly, it was in the end left to me. And Inigo had returned to the UK. So in those days, communication was telex. So I think I sent a 100-word telex back or something to Inigo and Dick Law saying, can't work on krill, have decided to do this. And I proposed an alternative project, which, to be fair, Inigo and I had talked about in outline beforehand. So it wasn't totally out of the blue. We'd had a discussion along the lines of, if you decide to drop the krill, this might be an interesting animal to look at, and that's what I did. But after that, it was left to me. And part of that work involved in bringing a large number of samples back, because I decided I was interested in chemistry and physiology, and how working in the Antarctic sets you a sort of problem with technical apparatus. It's a question of, do you take the apparatus to the animal, or do you take the animal to the apparatus? And in those days, the sort of equipment I needed to answer the questions I was interested in didn't travel. And so I had to bring the animals back, and I brought them back frozen. And so myself and Mike Richardson, who was bringing some material back from Sydney, and some of the doctors who were bringing medical samples back, there was a whole range of samples, but mine was probably the bulkiest. I brought back in a freezer. And that freezer was in the lab on the back of Bransfield. And of course, as it comes through the tropics, the freezer's working hard because there was no air conditioning of any consequence in the back lab, so it was reaching 30 Celsius in there. And the freezer was working overtime to keep the samples at minus 20, which was the threshold temperature that we needed. But a freezer is also a very good way of cooling beer. And so we used to check the freezers twice a day, and it became apparent that beer cans were being slung in there, or softies and other things in there. So we said, look, we stuck a notice on the door saying, these are valuable samples. They will be damaged if you keep opening them. Please, can you not use those fridges for those freezers for cooling beer? And the next night we went back and there was more beer in there. So and the notices had been ripped off. So okay, it's clearly something happening on the night shift. So what we'll do is we put a small lock on the fridge and we locked the door to the lab. That in those days, nowhere in the Antarctic was locked. No room was locked. I think the only thing that would be locked would maybe the firearms cabinet, because they still had them in those days. Everything else was left open. Oh, the medical area would have been locked as well. And we got there next morning, got round, the door was open. Went in, the fridge was empty. So we went upstairs to the mate and said, well, did you move the samples during the night? Did the fridge go? And he said, no, we didn't move any samples during the night. And it was one of these things where recognition as to what had happened slowly dawned. So we went down again and then it had a closer look at the lab and saw that actually what had happened was that the door had been leaving open with a crowbar. and the fridge had been levered open with a crowbar, and the entire contents of the fridge had been emptied over the side. That story is sort of well known. People remember it. What isn't so well known is actually that the people who did it actually tried to get in the side door, and they'd broken another door in, and that turned out to be the locker for the outboard engines, for the ribs. And I think it was 4 outboard engines were also thrown over the side, which was a non-trivial loss for the ship. Had they needed to rescue someone, for example, who'd fallen over the side of the ship, that would no longer have been possible. So that was not a simple or easy thing. I mean, it was quite a serious thing to have lost. Being on a ship in a small community, everybody knew who'd done it. I mean, clearly it wasn't the deck crew, because they would have known where the outboard motors were. It pointed to the engine room, and as happens in a small community, everybody knew who'd done it. But in the end, police were involved, and there was virtually no evidence other than a minor amount of forensic evidence. And my understanding is that it was decided not to prosecute because there was no possibility of a conviction given the evidence, and the people were denying it. So nothing ever happened over it. Although the rumour is that the 2 individuals concerned were blacklisted in terms of the Merchant Navy and never got a job again. But that, which people sort of nod and say, well, quite right too. But actually, it's not quite right, because they were never convicted of anything. And so you're damning someone's career on the basis of supposition and things. But that's the way the world works sometimes.
Did you ever establish a motive?
Our understanding is that the individuals concerned were under the influence of alcohol at the time and just were a bit annoyed to find out that they couldn't get in to cool their beer. And then just...
So they had no concept of what they were
Absolutely
destroying.
No, absolutely none. The other thing that I remember vividly from that particular incident was that I travelled down on John Biscoe with a newly appointed second officer, who was Stuart Lawrence. On the way back, Stuart had risen to be master of Bransfield, and so he was the master in charge of the ship, and hence responsible for anything that happened. And he was distraught. He was really... he was more upset than either Mike or I were. We just sort of said, oh, well, we had an attitude, well, there's no point in crying over spilt milk. We swore, we got drunk in the bar that night, probably. But Stuart felt this as a slight on his ship and everyone else. And he was more upset, I think, than either Mike or I were. At the time, and I haven't seen Stuart for a while, but whenever we see each other, we look back on it on occasions and remember. We can look back on it and laugh now, but at the time it was not funny.
Well, so apart from going to the bar, were you angry?
Surprisingly, no. I recall being annoyed. And recall also wondering what it would do to my PhD, because having changed projects, not in midstream, but early on in the stay at South Georgia, the data needed to bulk out a PhD, if I can put it that way, or to get enough data for a PhD, required the analysis of those samples. That was, I think, the thing that concerned me most. It was more a concern over whether I would have enough for a PhD than anger or anything else. I was annoyed, obviously, but nothing.
So how did it affect your scientific research? Did you have to go back?
Yes, I mean, it actually was a
pivot in disguise.
It was a pivotal moment. In retrospect, you could call it that. I mean, it was a pivotal moment in my career in that the ship northbound called in at Madeira. Bill Sloman got back on board together with some police officers to sort out what was going on. And Bill and I had this very interesting interview. And I'd already decided at that stage that I hadn't spoken to my parents or anything at that time, because the communication from a ship in the middle of the Atlantic was not feasible, really. You could put a dial in a phone call to Portishead Radio, but the reception was poor. And there were, at that early on, when it had actually happened, it wasn't even technically feasible to contact Portishead. We hadn't reached far enough north. But my Madeira it was, and I'd already decided, without talking to anyone, that if Bass offered me the opportunity to go back for a summer and collect the material again, I'd go. But I want to fly both ways to save time. So I had an interview with Bill Sloman, and it became apparent there that Bill was wondering how to broach the subject of going back with me, and I was sitting there wondering how to break the subject of going back with Bill. And eventually, I think there was a conversation along the lines of, cards on the table, Bill, I'll go back for another summer, but I want you to fly me both ways. Sign here, was virtually it. So I went back the following season. I mean, on a personal level, what was interesting about that was that this girlfriend that I'd left behind 2.5 years ago and had disappeared into the ether, as far as I knew, was standing on the jetty when I got back. And the next thing I had to tell her was that actually I'm going back for another 6 months, which didn't go down too well, but there we go. I mean,
is she actually your wife?
No. Okay. She was. I've been married twice.
Oh, I've been. Okay. Yeah. So you did. Okay.
We did get married, but it. Yeah. It
and then it's not. There's not this.
No. It didn't last.
Outside the perimeter. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I have subsequently had 2 freezer incidents of Bass, losing significant amounts of material. But that is anyone who does biochemistry or physiology will tell you that's par for the course. Freezers go down.
It wasn't enemy action.
No. One was a failure of the freezer unit. And that was simply the unit failed. The other was incompetence. We were having some shelving put up and the guys unplugged the freezer to plug in their power drill and didn't plug the freezer back in. Mm. And these things happen. There's nothing you can do about it. Yeah, and everyone has little moments like that in their career. And all you can do is carry on. Yeah.
Comparing that early work you did down south with more recent work in later in your life and the advent of these remote operated vehicles, there were several changes in the way that biologists went about collecting marine samples, weren't there? One was, in the early days, you were trawling the bottom, which of course eventually was not the thing to do because it destroyed the environment in which you were trawling.
Yes, I mean, I think that there have been huge developments in all fields over the 40 years, but in my field in biology, yes, I think, you know, the way we sample animals has been a significant change. Previously, you sampled blind. You threw a trawl over the side and dredged up everything it caught and then sorted through, threw the rubbish back over the side and took the animals you wanted. And it would be wrong to say that no one thought anything of it. We did think about the damage we were doing, but you accepted it. And you looked at it and said, well, you know, the cove we're fishing is very big, our trawl is very small, we're not doing that much damage. And actually, if you do the calculation, you're not doing that much damage. But there was a recognition as people changed their view of the natural world, and particularly their view of the sea, that this wasn't actually the right thing to do. And also, alternatives became available. So it became possible to scuba dive, but you can only scuba dive to a very shallow depth. Scuba diving, which sadly I can't do, because when they trained me up, I found out I have a Eustachian tube problem, which prevents me from diving. It's a congenital thing that runs in my mother's side of the family. And that meant I could never dive. And so that debarred me from, you know, seeing the animals in situ, which is something that I always regret, but it's just something that life has delivered. You deal with it. So I had to think of other things to do. So I bring the animals into the lab and work on them in the lab, but always knowing that I'm missing part of the story, which is seeing the animals in situ, which is what a terrestrial ecologist can do. They can see their insects on the leaves. They can go out and look at them in the field. For much of my career, I'm dealing with animals that have come up onto deck or latterly have been picked out by hand and brought up by assistance because I can't dive. And then most recently of all, we've got the advent of very high quality imagery and an ability to take those cameras to depth with ROVs and manipulators on them and things. So we can bring up individual animals, we can see the animals in situ. And the real challenge there, which I think actually some colleagues in the Antarctic have been leading the way internationally, these are German colleagues, it's easy to get lots of gee whiz video, high resolution, and it's spectacular. Whenever the video is feeding up, whenever the video is operating down there, there's always a feed in the bar or the lab, and huge numbers of people come and look at it because they're interested in seeing the seabed. So the camera's tracking along the seabed. There's always an attentive audience. People will bring their coffee down and sit in the lab just to watch what the video is recording. And it's great. You end up with lots of what we call gee whiz video. It's fantastic. But actually turning that into science is a real challenge. It's a difficult thing to do. You've got to get numbers out of it effectively. And going from imagery to data is not straightforward. But it's now routine. I mean, those problems have been cracked. We know how to do it. And some colleagues, as I say, in Germany and the Alfred Wegener Institute were amongst the world leaders for a while using their ROV in the Antarctic. So it's an area where I think Antarctic science actually for a while led the world. And the rest of the world has caught up now. And, of course, you know, the technology we use is far behind the technology used in industry. I mean, the ROVs used by the oil industry and the military far exceed the capabilities of ones that were available to scientists for a long time. Now they're probably on a par, but as everyone knows, you know, the technology available to the military is far in excess of capability of what's available to us.
When that technology was emerging, did you have to fight for it?
Not really, no. I don't think there was, it wasn't a question of fighting for it, but it was a question of having to raise the funds. So, as an example, in last amongst the last cruises that I did from NERC and Bass research vessels used the UK's only deep water ROV, an instrument called ISIS, which is based in Southampton. And that was £6 million to build. And so that was obviously not something that Bass or NOC or even NERC could probably do off its own back. And actually, it was the money came from a special pulse of money released by the government in recognition of the fact that over many years, the equipment and infrastructure available to the universities and the academic sector in general had slipped behind. And so they gave out a huge pulse of money to bring it up to date. And one of the bids that was made was for a deep water ROV. And if, as always, you know, opportunism is everything. It just so happened that there was an incident involving submarine and recovery of material from a submarine. I can't remember exactly the details, but I do remember that the UK had to utilise American deep water ROV expertise. And this was politically quite sensitive, and so just at that moment of sensitivity the money was released, and two very sharp individuals at NOC, National Oceanographic Centre in Southampton, struck with a bid for the UK's own deep water ROV, and the bid got put through. So it's like everything else, you need to be in the right moment at the right time. So the trick was finding the source of funds to build it, and of course, also to run it, because of course these things have significant running costs. It's, to run an ROV is a four-man team, and if you want to run the ROV round the clock, which you do when you're putting an expensive ship to sea, you want the ROV in the water all the time. You need more than four people because you've got watches to maintain. So it becomes very expensive in personnel and things. But it's been an absolute boon to underwater biology.
So, in a layman's question, but is it now? Towards the end of your career, was it presenting you with samples and specimens that you couldn't otherwise, would never have got to?
Yes, I mean, it was presenting me with experience that I could never otherwise have had, seeing animals in situ. And some of the animals that I'm watching on the video screens are animals that I've done work on, but have never actually seen in the environment behaving naturally. You see the environment that the animals live in a way that you won't otherwise do. So that was new. And it presented whole new swathes of data that we wouldn't otherwise have been able to get. And it was just visually one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I mean, I always rank, I think I'd say I've seen three really dramatic natural events in my life. I've seen a total eclipse of the sun. I've seen the Northern Lights wall to wall. And I've seen smoke events at depth in the sea. And I'd say they'd rank with each other. It's an interesting, the first time we located the vents, the lab was absolutely packed. We knew we were getting close because we had chemical signals.
This is volcanic
underwater vents. And yeah. They're called black smokers because what's actually happening is very hot water is emerging from the Earth's crust. And the instant it hits the cold sea, a lot of the minerals in the water crystallise out. So it looks like a smokestack, and it's actually mineral crystals. But they're called black smokers because the minerals are largely dark. And it's dark down there, so you're illuminating with the lights. And we knew we were getting there because we had all the chemical signals of sulfur and other things in the water. And so we knew pretty much that this was the dive we were going to find them. And the whole lab was packed.
It was actually on
James Cook, I think. This was on James Cook at the time because James Clark Ross was somewhere else. And there was a powerful emotional impact on the people when it was seen. It was comparable to people's first experience of whales. And that's just something else that I hadn't appreciated. You know, as a biologist, I saw my first whale and I was really quite excited. I wasn't prepared for the emotional impact that Seeing Great Whales has on non-biologists. Mm-hmm. And that still, I mean, it delights and staggers me that for some reason whales have an enormous emotional and powerful impact on people. And I don't fully understand it, but I mean, I love seeing them, but it's the impact on other people that sometimes...
So tell me again about a bit more about this this video screen that was being observed by nearly everybody on the boat. Well, it seems that way. Tell me, describe in more detail what that day.
Well, what happens is that when you're driving the ROV itself, you have what they call the ROV van. It's basically the lab that drives it. It's two containers bolted together. So you've got the space of two shipping containers.
On deck.
It's on deck, and it's dark. And one wall, it's like the Starship Enterprise. One wall is a complete array of video screens, because the ROV, when it's down there, has low-resolution cameras so you can look where you're going. It's got a sonar in case there's a wall ahead of you that you can't see. It's got a sonar looking back. It's got video cameras looking at the umbilical going back to the ship to make sure that that's okay. It's got strain meters. It's a hugely complicated thing. And you have a guy driving the ROV, a guy watching the tension, and another guy looking after the navigation at all times. So they're looking to make sure you don't run into things, or you can backtrack, or you're keeping on the track that the scientists want. And then behind them are three scientists on watch. And they're also recording all of the data cameras, high resolution, and they're recording them to digital video disc and to digital tape and to CD. And each one is done three times, twice. So there's an incredible amount of changing of media to go on. So it's quite complex. Someone else is recording also electronically and longhand interesting events as you go along, saying, you know, crab or fish or whatever, and these are all recorded at the same time. The biologist is then saying, take a photograph of that one, we want that one. So it's quite an intense thing, and for that reason general people not involved in watchkeeping are not allowed in the van, because otherwise you disturb the process, and you don't want to wrap £6 million worth of umbilical around the ship's propeller. So what they do is they have a large plasma screen TV in the general lab, which is relaying one of those video streams. And the one they relay is the high-resolution biological camera, because that's generally the pretty pictures. And so everyone else who isn't on watch and who's interested in sits around in the main lab, which is a big spacious lab, watching this TV. And the engineers off watch will come in with their softie or their cup of tea. You're not supposed to have teas in the lab, but everyone takes them in and sits around. And often there'll be five or six people watching the video. On the occasion that we found the vents, there were probably 20 or 25 people watching the video. And it's just, it's the old thing, but the tension mounts. You know, we're nearly there. The images start to show suddenly that you're entering a vent field, and the ones you see are not smoking, they're dead ones, because the vents have a relatively limited lifespan. They probably only run for a few years. You find dead vents. We're in the right area. And then you start seeing the animals, because the dead vents don't have animals around them. Then you start seeing animals that are probably indicating there's a vent nearby, and then you see more animals. The tension builds. I mean, you couldn't write the script. And then eventually the camera suddenly goes dark as you enter a smoke field, and there's an enormous cheer, and everyone's sort of it's exciting. I mean,
are you seeing things, creatures you've never seen before?
Yes, in the sense that... the types of creatures are well known. I mean, we're seeing starfish, we're seeing crabs, galathead crabs, we're seeing snails, we're seeing worms. Those are all well known to people, but it's the type of crab and the type of worm that's different. And they're distinctively different, so you know they're new. So it's not that you're not seeing little green men or anything. You're not seeing anything outlandish that you've never seen before. They're all well-known types of animal, but the individual forms are different. One of the starfish, for example, that we came across quite frequently and we soon learnt was symptomatic of being close to an active vent, was a very characteristic starfish with seven arms. Starfish normally have five arms. And our first thought was that must be something that's damaged in some way and grown two extra arms. And no, the next one, that's got seven arms too. That one's got seven arms. So that goes down a seven-armed starfish. And it's only on collecting a sample, which we did, use the manipulator to put one of these in the box, bring it to the surface, take samples for DNA analysis, and then the rest of the animal is preserved. And somebody will have to look at that to work out, the echinoderm people on starfish people on board know roughly what sort of starfish it is. But we also know that it's never been seen before.
I can see the value of a pure science, just recognising a new species that hasn't been seen before. But these are animals living in a very specialised immediate environment, I guess if they drifted too far away from the vent, they wouldn't survive. Have you learned anything that's really useful in your time from?
It depends how you define useful.
Well, useful to mankind.
Not in the immediate sense, no. I mean, one of the things... I'll answer this in a slightly oblique way.
Yeah, useful anyway.
Yeah. One of the things that's changed in the way government views science over the 40 years that I've been here is that I've been doing science, is to move from a recognition that there is a general value for mankind in understanding the world, and a recognition also that the things that are going to generate large amounts of money will often be things that you hadn't expected. Mm. I mean, unexpected. Everyone talks about Teflon and the space race, but that's a trivial example. There are many more fundamental examples than that. And we've moved to a system of very much more prescribed science where you are expected to demonstrate, even before you start, what the benefits to the country are, by which is meant, will the Treasury get money from it? In that sense, the work on hydrothermal vents has contributed nothing. No, we won't get any money from it initially. What it has contributed is a much improved understanding of one aspect of how the world works. And so in that sense, it's exciting. I mean, we have discovered things about them that we hadn't known before. But in a scientific context, it's really very important. I mean, one of the to take an example, which is easy to sort of express. One of the reasons we were interested in the vents in the Antarctic is that we now have enough work done on the vents in the Pacific and the vents in the Atlantic to know that the animals you find in Atlantic vents are very different from the animals you find in Pacific vents. Some types of worms, for example, are only found in the Pacific. Some types of crustaceans are only found in the Atlantic. So what you see around a vent is very different in the Atlantic from what you see around a vent in the Pacific. So the obvious question is, since we're looking at vents not that far from the Drake Passage, are these going to be Atlantic-type vents? Are they going to be Pacific-type vents? Or are they going to be halfway between? And the answer is all three of them. They have some links through to Atlantic, they have some similarities to Pacific, but they also have lots of things that make them distinctive in their own right. So we're learning something about how vents work. Understanding how the energy supply from the vent to the animals works gives you an increased understanding of how energy flows in systems. So that, at some stage, may well be useful. At this stage, it's just an intellectual advance in understanding how the world operates. And it has no obvious immediate benefit to mankind, other than better knowledge. But sometimes interesting things emerge.
So at the time, it was felt that it was £6 million well spent.
Well, yes, I mean, I think that there is a general recognition that this is a good piece of kit. Whether work on the vents in the Antarctic in itself justifies £6 million is probably arguable, but the general advance of knowledge that we have and the capability that it delivers to just maybe solve, it might solve a technical problem at some stage, I think it's recognised as being a good investment in science.
And that was when, Andy?
Oh, I don't know. That would probably be of the order of after 2000.
Oh, right.
It's 2005, maybe. I would guess around 2005, but hindsight has a tendency to telescope time.
The question I want to ask you is, if that proposal is being made today in the current economic climate in the world of science, would they still say the £6 million is worth spending?
I'm not sure that you'd be able to get the £6 million. I think it's probably that's not an answer to the question you asked.
No, it is.
But yeah. It's an alternative answer. At the moment, money's very tight, so I don't think you'd actually be able to raise the money. And the money for that did come from a specific pulse of money to introduce new equipment and infrastructure to universities. And that was why, in the end, for example, the equipment is housed at the University of Southampton. It's actually in a joint facility with NERC, but it's in the university sector that generated the argument for it, rather than NERC.
Were you, at the time that you were preparing to retire, were you aware that science was not getting the kind of money it used to get?
Yes. In the time that I worked at Bass, I'd say there have been cycles. There have been periods when the money available for science in general in the UK in the 60s, for example, was generally very good. Then there were periods of financial constraint, which were largely driven by UK-wide things, recessions, the three-day week. We all remember such times. And then there have been times when the money's been relatively freely available. And I think there's a distinction to be drawn here in that post-Falklands, the money was good specifically for Bass. In the 1960s, before I joined, effectively, I think money for science in general was good. Obviously, one gets to know the cohort of people you move through the organisation with. And a number of my colleagues have retired around the same time as I have. There's a group of us who retired over a 3 or 4 year period. Many of us have spent our entire, or almost all, or all our science careers in Bass. And I think we agree that we happen to be born at the right time. We all missed the war. So I don't remember rationing, but I remember the end of rationing. And we lived at a time when there was a general goodwill towards technology and science. And science was well funded, partly on the basis of the war experience, that technology generally was a good thing. And that changed over the course of time. Other priorities came in. It was costing more and more, for example, to generate food. It was costing more and more to keep people healthy. The budget isn't limitless. And so those are political decisions. But as a result, this era of sort of good funding for science moved into a much more competitive area. And as we all know, there are pressures on public service pensions and other such things. So I think I represent a cohort that managed to have a science career when we didn't have to struggle to find a job. There was generally good funding for the science we wanted to do. Post-Falklands, there was good funding for what we wanted to do in the Antarctic. And we were able to retire before the real squeeze on public sector pensions came in. So I think we've lived in a golden era. And I do think we recognise it as well. The recognition involves trying to work out ways of making it less tough for the people that come after us. And we tried to do such things at the time, but you're limited in what you can do because your hands are tied by UK-wide factors.
Let's pause and reconvene shortly.
Right.